So got a lot of great questions. We're not going to be able to get to everything. I do appreciate you submitting your questions. I'll try as best as I can to summarize those questions here. And Rich, Doug, either of you are able to answer any one of these. So feel free to jump in when you need to. First question, fun one here. What do you think of Paula White being appointed as the head of the White House Faith Office? What do you think about having a White House Faith Office? Who would you choose? Rich, I think we heard your answer. Doug, I'll let you take this one first.
It gets her out of the pulpit.
What's that?
It gets her out of the pulpit.
That's definitely looking on the bright side.
Yeah, the problem with an office like that is we still live in a generic. You could have a rabbi or a Buddhist priest or people who are outside the Christian tradition entirely, which is not what we're after. We're after the Christian faith being acknowledged, Christ being acknowledged, and we would want biblically qualified people to be in that position. So it's. It's better sort of in some ways than it used to be, but it's still not what we're after.
This is another political question. How do we determine when a leader has abdicated or forfeited their office? Who determines that? Who determines the actions that should be taken?
So this, I would key off of what Rich was saying in his talk, and that is the leadership role of the church. Who spoke for the church in the showdown with Mary, Queen of Scots? Well, it was John Knox. It was the pulpit that was the mouthpiece of the church. When the church is interacting with the culture, then the spokesman of the state is going to be speaking, and the spokesman of the church is going to be speaking, and that's going to be the pulpit. And this is why you need great churches / influential churches where the state does something and the reporters need to know who to call.
Rich, this is a question for you. Both of you can chime in. To what degree should the church as an institution be involved in civil matters? Okay, this is, and here's a couple other questions kind of related to this. Is cultural change the highest priority for the church? Does that make the church a means to an end? How do we keep gaining national power and influence from becoming an idol for the church?
Yeah, that's a good question because that is a danger, and in some ways you can see that's what's happened in much of the West, is that the church basically allowed itself to pursue political power at the price of great compromise. I think with a lot of the, say, state churches of Europe and that kind of thing, that's clearly what happened. But I would say that the goal is the fullness of Christ's kingdom. Like that is the goal. So that's not just. So I would say that's what we're aiming at is you could call that a Christian civilization or the manifestation of the kingdom. That's our earthly goal for the church's mission. Obviously, there's an eternal heavenly goal as well, but that I would say is the earthly historical goal of the church. And as a post-millennialist, I would say I think it's what God has promised us too. So we're not just aiming at a target that can never be hit. We're aiming at something that God has promised to do. If you look at Psalm 2 that I made reference to, yes, Jesus does smash the nations with his rod of iron, but he also inherits the nations. So the nations become his redemptive possession. He died to purchase the nations, and he will have them. So the mission of the church and the promises of the Father to the Son, they converge. But yeah, there is always that danger. And so the church does have to seek to stay faithful and stay salty. That's the metaphor Jesus has given to us. Read the first part of that question again.
To what degree should the church as an institution be involved in civil matters? And there's a citation of Westminster Confession 31 that talks about extraordinary
right.
cases.
Yes, I did want to comment on that. That's why I wanted you to read it again. So I don't think that pastors or church councils need to comment on every single piece of legislation that comes down the pike. The problem we have today is that everything has been politicized. Okay, so the definition of a man or the definition of a woman is now a political question. Okay, not just a biological question, it's a political question. Okay, and of course it's always a theological question. Or the issue of life in the womb. I mean, that's obviously a political question, but it's also an ethical question and a theological question. So I don't think you need pastors commenting on every single political issue that comes up. I think we do need to stay in our lane, and I do believe in sphere sovereignty, and we've got our jurisdiction, the state's got its jurisdiction, the family's got its jurisdiction. So we need to respect those institutional boundaries, those sphere boundaries, but there are lots of times where there's overlap. Okay? The question about life in the womb is not just a political question for the politicians to sort out. It's also a theological question that the Word of God has a lot to say about, and pastors need to proclaim that and make that known. So I would say the big ticket items, that's where the church should spend its political capital, discipling its own people, and insofar as the state will listen to us in our advisory role, teaching these things, proclaiming these things, that's how I would look at it, those things that are the big ticket items.
I agree with that completely. You don't want a 13-part sermon series on the garbage rotation policy of the... that's the church getting out of its lane. But all of our battles today are fighting to get the state out of our lane. Right. So that's the issue. We're fighting the encroachments of the state because they've taken moral issues, basic moral issues, and turned them into partisan political issues. And so we have to fight that and fight it from the pulpit. The second thing is, this is exactly right, that a lot of churches have forfeited their moral capital by pursuing political power as an end. But this is the way the kingdom works. Seek first the kingdom, all these things will be added unto you. So the key to political cultural influence for the church is for the church to care about faithfulness more than political influence. If you care about faithfulness more than political influence, you will have political influence. If you care about political influence as your goal number one, you're going to sell out in the first 10 minutes.
Should Christian kids get a Christian college education?
If they get a college education, that's an open question. Like currently about 30% of Americans have a college degree, and if we really discipline ourselves, we could cut that in half. So college is not for everybody, but if you want a college, you want a faithful one, right? So if a kid is gifted that way and wants to pursue that kind of life, that kind of vocation, then absolutely he should go to college, she should go to college. Very grateful for the parents who send their kids to New St. Andrews, but I don't believe that college is for everyone. But I think that we should be educated faithfully as far as a faithful education is available.
Yeah, I would agree with that in principle. I would add a couple wrinkles. I would say by the time your child is 18, I would say if you've done your work well, you should be able to launch them out into the world, whether that's the workforce where they're going to encounter all kinds of things, or if they do end up in a secular college, because let's say that's where they would need to go to get the kind of degree to pursue the kind of
pre-med,
the kind of work. Yeah. So I think if we say no Christian should go to secular colleges, we're not going to have any Christian doctors or lots of other vocations that Christian colleges are not providing us. You know, there's not enough opportunities there. But I would say if you've done your work well by the time your child is 18, let's say that they don't go to college and your child is going to be a carpenter. He's probably going to be around a lot of ungodly people in his field, and he has to be prepared to deal with that by that age. I would say the same thing is true of college. By the time your child's 18, hopefully they have been trained well enough that they could deal with whatever they might encounter in a secular classroom and the cultures there. Now, I would still say there are a lot of criteria that Christian parents should use in thinking about where their children go. You would want to send them to a school where obviously there's a strong and faithful Christian community and Christian churches and so forth. You don't want to just, you know, just abandon them in any kind of way, obviously. And in the South, I think we have a lot more opportunities to do that because we have a lot more state schools that have a very strong conservative and Christian presence. So it might even depend on what region of the country you live in. I would say the first question is, should my child go to college at all? The second question is, you know, what do they want to do? What's the best pathway to get there? I would say that if you've done your work, they ought to be able to deal with what a secular college environment is going to throw at them, if that's the best pathway for them. And if not, I would say you don't have any business sending them anywhere.
Yeah, and I agree with that, because even in the secular world, there are degrees like engineering where most of what you learn in a secular school is true. Most of what you still have to learn how to handle ungodly classmates and the instructor. So the only thing I would wave parents off from is garbage degrees, where most of what you learn is false and corrupting and just worthless, underwater basket weaving from a feminist perspective.
Doug, you mentioned Dabney in your talk. What were the warning signs that Dabney identified in the direction of the public school was going?
The warning sign was the enemy that he identified correctly was the attempt to teach in a secular way without reference to God. So he said that's a pipe dream. It can't happen. There's no such thing as true secularism. Secularism is simply the transition state between abandoning the Christian God and adopting other gods. So he said a secular neutral education is as impossible as teaching in dark caverns. You can't do it. It's not going to happen. So that was the warning sign, secularity, secularism.
What advice would either of you have for encouraging friends who have their kids in government schools? They're in the South. They cite, you know, there's a lot of good Christians teaching in the public school. They have access to sports and other things that maybe some of the classical schools wouldn't be as strong in. They want them to have some exposure, especially in the high school years, to the world before college. What are some specific ways that they can challenge these friends to rethink their stance?
I would just look at the attrition rates. Are we gaining? Let's say you do the optimum thing and you homeschool your kids up through ninth or tenth grade, and you put them in the high school to be salt and light. And let's say they're a squared away kid and they don't lose their faith, right? Let's take 1,000 examples. Out of those, out of that 1,000, how many do lose their faith? And how many non-Christian kids come to the faith as a result of salt and light? I would say that the way a lot of Christian parents read the odds, they should make sure to never go to Vegas.
So let me say one other thing about that. When we talk about educating our covenant children, you know, covenant children should be given a covenant education. The purpose of an education is not mere survival. It's not like, oh, my kid got through 12th grade in the public school and did not apostatize. Yes, but did they really learn how to think about all things in light of Christ's lordship? Did they really learn how to think about American history and about atoms and about mathematics as a Christian? And so the goal is not merely survival. Oh, my kid survived public school. It should be training warriors, making disciples. I mean, the Christian school is really an extension of the family and what the family is called to do in discipling children. So it's Deuteronomy 6. There was an article, I think it was in Christianity Today a while back, and of course it was written by a woman who did not yet have kids, but talking about how when she did, she's going to put them in public school, that she thought that was the more Christian thing to do. And what struck me about the article is that it did not interact with anything the Bible says about how we are to raise our children. All the arguments were very pragmatic and really sort of, I mean, if you can even call them arguments, they're really more emotional appeals. But Deuteronomy 6, teaching your children the word of God at all waking moments. Ephesians 6, training them in the paideia, the nurture and admonition of the Lord, none of that was interacted with. And so I think we have to go back to first principles and say, well, what is the purpose of education is an extension of your purpose as parenting. As a parent, what you want to do is raise up a discipled warrior for the kingdom of Jesus. And having your child in K through 12 public education is not a way to do that. Your child might survive it. There are many, you know, the reality, because I've had this conversation many times, and people will say, well, yes, my friend, they had their kids in the public schools, and they all turned out fine, and then I know another family that they had their kids in the Christian school, and they apostatized. Well, yes, that can happen, but the question's not just, what are the odds? I think that's a good question to ask, but it's also, what's the purpose of education to begin with, and what is your goal for your child by the time they're 16 or 18 years old? What are you aiming to produce? And it should be, you know, we've got 18 years. You know, Psalm 127 talks about the children, you know, the righteous man's children are like arrows in the hand of a warrior. You've got 18 years to straighten and sharpen those arrows. You better do the best possible job of it you can.
Another education question. Alabama recently passed a school choice bill where parents can receive back tax dollars that they can put toward a school of their choice. What considerations should schools and parents have in accepting that money back from the state?
So there's a Machiavellian me and a principled school board member me. At Logos School, I would want us to never take vouchers or anything like that, because the state is going to think if money goes from the taxpayer to them and then they give the money back, they think it's them being generous. They think it's a gift from them, and you take the king's coin, you become the king's man. So they're going to try to control private schools by that means. At the same time, although vouchers are a bad idea, I think tuition tax credits or education savings accounts that are tax-free, like some health accounts where you keep your money and the money never goes to the state. That kind of school choice program I'd be enthusiastically in favor of. Now, all of that said, I wouldn't want our school to take voucher money that's coming from the government, because I smell a rat. I smell a trap in that. But the Machiavelli in me wants to say go, because I think it's all part of the wrecking ball. I think the public school establishment is teetering, and if the Department of Education goes down and charter schools spring up everywhere, I don't think charter schools are a good thing, but I think they might be a good wrecking ball for the monolithic system that exists now. So that's the Machiavelli in me speaking.
Thanks.
In terms of the state situation, I know we've got a lot of Christian schools in the area looking into what strings might be attached, how the system's going to work. So I think there's a lot still there to be determined. And certainly, I think a healthy skepticism about it is good, because you don't want to be taking money where strings are attached or where strings could be attached later. You don't want to build up a Christian school that's totally dependent on this government system, and then 10 years later the government says, aha, but since you're taking our money, we now have these requirements for you. That's a dangerous game to play. I just think we need to see how it works out in Alabama. I'm hopeful that we can get a good system in place, which I think that could be a great turning point, but I think there's also some reasonable concern.
Also, a school could protect itself by, if they take money, if money starts coming in as a result of this, just put it all into capital improvements and not have any of it go into their operating budget, so they don't become dependent on that money. Basically, don't ever get into a situation where they've got you over a barrel.
Thank you. This is a very practical question. Again, context is a school setting. Thoughts on the appropriateness of women leading in worship music or teaching Bible during school chapel in a classical Christian school, and maybe some advice on how to deal with that.
Maybe this is my opportunity to make a mess for Rich to clean up.
Too late.
Too late. So I would say nope, 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 nope. Basically, you're training kids. You're training the kids how this should go. And you, if the chapel program is being run like a quasi-worship service, you don't want to do something and then you move from Friday afternoon to Sunday and they've been schooled in this as a normal expectation. So I don't have a problem with a woman in a Christian school teaching math or teaching history, but I would want women not teaching the Bible classes. I don't have any problem with teaching Bible to the third graders, but when you get to the point where the male students are taller than she is, then you're creating a dynamic that is it's training them. It's what they think is normal, what they think is ordinary. And you don't want to say, okay, now Sunday morning, all the rules are different. That would include the kind of music you sing, that would include the flavor of the chapel service or the assembly. So I think it would be just wisest to stay away.
Rich, this one's for you on the church. Practical tips on whether to stay and reform existing churches, maybe that are not in an ideal place, or join other faithful churches or plant. What principles and practical tips do you have?
Well, some of it is going to depend on your situation. Are you an officer in the church or seeking to reform? Or are you just simply a member of the church? Or are you in a position of power and influence? How welcome are the reforms you're going to seek to be making? How welcome are those reforms? If you're if you find that you're actually now on a completely different page than the leadership of the church you've been in, it's probably going to be very unwelcome for you to try to change things, and you'll probably create a lot of division. And you would probably be better off saying, "I love you as brothers, but we don't share the same vision anymore for what this church should be, and I would be better off at a like-minded place, at a more like-minded place." So I think it really depends on your situation. In some cases it's the pastor who wants to bring reform, and I would say, well, he's got a great opportunity. He might have to move slowly based on where his people are, but he can bring reform. So it really just kind of depends on the situation. But if somebody came into my church and wanted to change everything, I would say, you might be better off finding a church where you're more aligned. And I think that's generally going to be the case. And if there are those unique situations where you can change a church because there's a lot of openness to the direction you think the church needs to go. But there's a lot of cases where trying to change the direction of a church would be very divisive, and you'd be better off going to a place where there's already more like-mindedness.
Amen.
Here's a family question. How should a husband think about leading his wife who's not in tune with the news or cultural political conversations, maybe just doesn't have an interest? To what degree should he keep her informed? Suggestions on how he should do that?
I don't think that everybody in a family has the obligation to stay current with everything. I would say if he's interested in it, he should keep her apprised at the level of dinner table conversation, just what we're talking about during the day. If she's not interested in listening to this podcast, she's almost certainly not interested in listening to him repeat the whole podcast. So don't do that. But basically, if you're talking with the kids, and I think a family can stay generally current about with summaries or dinner table chatter, that kind of level. If the lack of interest is a lack of interest just because I'm busy, I'm a busy mom, I don't have time. Those guys are just talk. That's a noble sentiment. Somebody's got to listen to it, but not everybody. But sometimes a wife might be disengaged and disinterested because she's not interested in church either, and she's not interested in the bigger questions and that sort of thing. That is an issue where he should be praying about how to bring her along and how to have deeper conversation with her.
I totally agree with that. I just want to point out you can have the opposite problem too, of being too obsessed with knowing about everything that's going on, and that can happen, of course, to women or men both. but that's also a concern. We do need to be informed. There's a great J.C. Ryle quote where he says, basically, you know, if you think you can be, you know, ignorant of what's happening in your church and in your nation, he says you're both a bad church member and a bad patriot. You do need to have some knowledge of what's going on in the world around you. But not everybody has the same obligations. Not everybody's going to have the same responsibility to know what's going on. That, as Doug talked about, say the woman who's very much given to raising her children, and she's, you know, those things are occupying her time, and so her lack of, it's really just lack of time or opportunity to know about these other things. That's totally fine. She does not have to know about every little thing that happens. But I also think there is this other extreme where people get so obsessed with knowing every single thing, and of course now with the way social media works, it can really become a distraction from what are your main obligations, what should be your main vocation, what should absorb most of your time and your energy. And I think we've ended up in a situation where a lot of people are very worried about things that they have no real contact with and can't do anything about. And that's not a healthy place to be either.
Should the church be involved in matchmaking? It seems many Christian singles are often resorting to dating apps.
We can start right now.
Should we go by height or alphabetical?
Ho, ho, ho. I would say yes, but very judiciously and cautiously. There are some people in the church that need help. They need to be encouraged. My dad, who's now with the Lord, used to say of men, if you're 27 and single and don't have the gift of celibacy, find out her name and ask. You know? And some guys need to have a fire lit under them and, you know, come on. They need that kind of encouragement and help. At the same time, I don't think the church should be known as a matchmaking church. It's hazardous because when people pair up, sometimes it's a bad match. And they're not successful. And the last thing in the world you need is the church to be blamed for quote unquote coercing us or pressuring us to go down this road. But pastors counsel people, and unmarried in a way you don't desire is a common pastoral problem. And pastors should be willing to help with that as opportunity arises.
Pastors' wives should handle the matchmaking. I'll just say this. You got to distinguish the church as an institution from the church as a community. The church as an institution doesn't need to be in the matchmaking business. As a community, your network of friends and family, and yes, that can include your pastor and elders and their wives and so forth, can be very helpful in finding a suitable spouse.
And you have to understand that even if you understand the crucial distinction between church as institution and church as community, if you've got a strong personality in the pulpit or strong leadership, a lot of the rank and file parishioners won't make that distinction. And so you've got to make sure that they know what hat you're wearing if you get into this.
Doug, can you give some examples of funner?
Give some examples of funner. One of the things that we did, Nancy and I would do when our kids were little, we'd put them all to bed, and we had a routine to putting them to bed, and we'd pray with them and sing with them and do all the things, and then we'd put them to bed. We'd go out in the living room, and about 10 minutes later, I'd yell, "Jammy ride." And jammy ride meant everybody piles out of bed in their jammies and heads out to the car. And we go get some ice cream. All right, that's the kind of thing I mean by funner.
Thank you. What about some advice for parents who are physically unable to have children? What are their responsibilities in the church?
So there are several things. I would say couples in that position oftentimes look toward adoption, foster parenting, adoption, which is a good and noble thing to do. The one pastoral caution I would say is don't adopt children because you are feeling needy. okay? You don't want to adopt anybody or to meet your needs. That kind of neediness can get you into trouble. So you should be overflowing and wanting to give. And so adoption, foster parenting can be a good thing. In the church, if children are not an option, you can be, there are a lot of kids in the church, you can be the equivalent of an uncle and an aunt, helping Christian parents who've got their hands full with taking the load off, helping out, but just keeping it at the uncle and aunt level, not a substitute parent.
Yeah, that's really good. I would echo that advice about adoption. Adoption should be about healing a wound in the child's life, not the adult's life. There's a great chapter in Katie Faust's book, Them Before Us, where she really lays out very well, I think it's a very helpful way of thinking about adoption. So I would say yes. And I do think the idea of the church as an extended family, I mean, obviously the church is composed of households, but the church also is a household. And so thinking of the church that way, thinking about the, you know, Doug made reference to the vows that we take as a church body, as a church family, when a child is baptized. And, you know, so in the Presbyterian tradition, you would not have God parents. You wouldn't have just two people stand up there and take the vow. You'd have a God family, and the whole congregation would take the vow. And I think if you find yourself, obviously, if you're a married couple struggling with infertility, that is a trial. That's an affliction, and you want to take that to the Lord. And certainly things like foster care and adoption are a way to pursue, have expanding your family. But I would also say thinking about the church as a family can be a very helpful way to go about it too.
Thank you. Is there a relationship between the decline in infant baptism and parents sending their kids to government schools?
No offense, but I would say that it's not so much like causation, like one thing causing the other. I would say that American culture is a Baptistic culture. And I believe that the individualism that began in the early, began to take root in the frontier era, early 19th century, 1800 to 1830, had a number of consequences. And I think one of the consequences was the government school system. Another consequence was the flourishing of Baptist churches and Baptistic type of churches. So I would look for a common, I think that Baptist theology and culture is more individualistic than other forms like Presbyterian and Anglican and Magisterial. And I think because we went down the individualism route, it had certain consequences, and those would be two of the consequences.
You could compare it to Europe, which did not become Baptistic in the way that America did, and yet the practice of paedobaptism, and so they continued to practice paedobaptism, but that did not stop the slide into secularization. So it's really important to understand, as significant as the sacraments are, as markers of the church, you know, baptism is our entrance into the church, the communion meal as a way of marking out the church and sustaining the life of the church in a particular kind of way. It's really important to understand sacraments by themselves only make hell that much hotter for you. They have to be combined with a living and active and obedient faith. So infant baptism by itself is only going to intensify judgment. It's got to be infant baptism as part of a whole package, a whole covenant package that includes the nurture that follows, and that includes being part of having a faithful family life and faithful church life. It's got to be all of that together. Paul in 1 Corinthians 10 reminds the Corinthians that, hey, the Israelites in the wilderness, they had a baptism, they had spiritual food and spiritual drink, and every single one of them perished in the wilderness. And that'll be you too, unless you receive these sacraments and then live out what you've been given with an obedient faith.
And then if we could make the same distinction, and it sometimes goes the other way, because in the 1980s, the resurgence of things like homeschooling was driven by many Baptist families, Baptist curricula, that sort of thing. And that created certain cognitive dissonance issues for them. But they were the ones who took family seriously, and not with my kids you don't. And so we should commend that. And it led to, it sometimes leads to delicious inconsistencies. I had a Reformed Baptist friend who was becoming Paedo Baptist around the same time that I was. And we got to know each other by phone, trading stories. And he said he was one of three elders in a Reformed Baptist church. And he was having a theological debate with one of the other elders in the hallway of the church. And the other elder was saying, look, little children hate God. Little children hate God. They're God haters. You have to understand that. And he said, right then, one of the Sunday school classes let out, and all the kids came out with a paper plate tied to their chest that said, I love God. So I would say that Baptist churches would practice infant dedications, for example, as Nancy and I did when our kids were little. We weren't Paedo Baptists at the time, but our children were God's children, and we taught them to pray, we dedicated them. So there are many, many Baptist families who are living more faithfully in this regard than many ostensibly Paedo Baptist families.
Both of your talks alluded to Christendom, Christian civilization. What books would you recommend for Christians seeking to understand what those mean?
Well, there's this book called Mere Christendom, right? that might help.
There's another one coming out. I put together a primer on Christian nationalism, that's just Q&A, in the aftermath of all the controversy from Mere Christendom and Stephen Wolfe's book and people hollering about it. There's a Q&A coming out.
I'll just say, since Doug talked about his book, I can do it too, I guess. My book, Measures of the Mission, was really written to answer that question.
Thank you. Last question here for both of you. Could you tell us some authors who have influenced you most, and what books would you recommend by them and why?
Well, I was influenced by a lot of Doug's books, which is true. So I think particularly Doug's books on the family are wonderful. They were core to our family life. Those are books I'd want to put in the hands of every one of my congregants, because I just think they really distill so much biblical truth and biblical wisdom. Peter Lighthart, who was walking around here a few minutes ago, his book, The Kingdom and the Power, which is actually an older book back in the 90s, is really, really good. A lot of what I said kind of flows out of just thinking about things he says in that book. And he did kind of an updated, sort of more esoteric version of it called Against Christianity at some point. That was a super helpful book. And then, of course, I mentioned Calvin. People see, oh, Calvin's Institutes, it's two big volumes. It's 1,500 pages. I could never read that. It's actually very readable. And so I would say don't shy away from reading the classics. They're classics for a reason. So reading Calvin and Luther and people like that, I think, is very, very valuable.
I would just throw out a few names. It'd be, C.S. Lewis has had more of an impact on me than everybody else put together. So C.S. Lewis is just, he can edify me at the same time he's exasperating me. I can say, what do you do? But it's really good. Like, Reflections on the Psalms has got some awful stuff in it. But it's a wonderful book. He's got a rare talent there. I greatly benefited from the early Rush Dooney. Some of his early seminal works were very helpful at a theological, structural level for me. And I would also say John Calvin's Institutes.
Great. Thank you both. Thank you to our speakers. Let's give them a round of applause.